Hi, my name is Noel Bell, and I'm a psychotherapist based in London. And in this podcast, I'm absolutely thrilled to be speaking to the prolific author Scott Miller in the Chicago area. Scott's latest book is Better Results: Using Deliberate Practice to Improve Psychotherapeutic Effectiveness. So that's going to be the broad sweep of what we're going to be chatting about. So, Scott, how are you doing?
I'm good. A little weary of all of the issues with regard to COVID-19, but I would say, everything considered, I'm doing well.
So, Scott, as I said with the introduction, it was with honest humility when I say you're a prolific author and publisher of articles as well. So the emphasis will be on your latest book, Better Results: Using Deliberate Practice to Improve Therapeutic Effectiveness. Let's go on a little tangent, just on in terms of theory. I've been reading Dick Schwartz. Are you familiar with the IFS? Yeah. So, interestingly, Richard Schwartz would be... This might sound a bit harsh on him. I don't think there's necessarily anything terrifically terrific. I mean, I think he borrows from so many different sources. But one thing I think is very interesting is he disputes the pathology of multiple states. Instead, he talks about parts and the idea that we, or at least medic clinicians, are very quick to pathologize. Where are you on that debate, that there's no such thing really as multiple state, multiple personality disorder, that really we just have to learn?
Well, I don't think I'm going to solve this particular debate. I can say that idea of Dick Schwartz can be traced all the way back to a guy named Saul Rosenzweig back in the 1930s, who was in the same graduating class at Harvard as B.F. Skinner. And he said at that particular time that people were much better viewed as multiverses rather than universes, that there wasn't some core organizational identity, that was a fiction, and that what we were was multiple identities depending on the context in which we're in. Saul is also the person who said that he didn't understand this debate between the various treatment approaches, saying that he thought that all of them were probably better viewed as cultural manifestations that shared the same common DNA or common factors in terms of what led to effectiveness. So, I think probably things are on a spectrum where you have certain identities that on the spectrum, on the far end, could be deeply problematic. And then in the middle, where they're largely functional, and then perhaps on the other side, where the identities aren't firm enough. And you may need some help on that end as well. So I don't really have a sense about it. I think much of what occupies therapists' attention is a waste of time, and is primarily something that's interested to them. The outcome data suggest some qualities of effective therapeutic work that are just not as provocative, interesting, dare I use the word sexy. They just don't attract our attention in the same way. They're rather boring and mundane. But we seem to be interested in chasing constantly some new theory, some new way of working, even though when I look at the data, I can't see that any of the things we've been fascinated with over the last 40 years has contributed much to improved outcomes.
Yes, I would just say, though, and I totally get what you're saying, absolutely, especially when new approaches become very proprietary and you kind of think, what's going on there? That said, just purely anecdotally, anytime I have explored with clients to dialogue with the so-called parts of themselves that are very troublesome and that have extreme vulnerabilities attached to them, and not to kind of seek to get rid of that part, but to actually dialogue with it as IFS suggests, not that I'm an IFS practitioner, but I think often clients really latch on to that, because then they deal with their shame and their fear of contacting a very vulnerable part of them. And then if they can free the negative emotion from that part so that that part can thrive elsewhere in their life, there can be sometimes benefits, and they can sort of understand that language. But
And you know, I wouldn't dispute the impact of what you've just said. What I would say is that the theory surrounding it is probably far more complicated than it needs to be. Parts and anxiety and strangulated emotions. Essentially, what you've described for me is a core, well-established core principle of effective change, and that's empathy. Whether you're extending empathy from the outside in, me providing it for my client, or the client is somehow able to provide that for themselves. But you know, you say empathy and everybody nods their head, oh yes, we understand what that is. Now tell me something interesting.
Yeah.
And then we're off discussing parts or whatever it is. I don't have anything against that. I don't know enough about it actually to be critical, except to say much of what we hear is rehashed in updated cultural terms, basic core principles that have long been found to contribute mightily to the outcome. So empathy is one of them. The effect size of empathy is in hundreds and hundreds of studies is about 0.6. The challenge for me is most of us get very little training on that. So the last time you saw a workshop with a world leader come and they were going to spend 2 days talking about empathy, most people can't even recall a time. Generally, empathy is given sort of a short course in graduate school. And instead, we're chasing some advanced theory, whether that's the new interest in our how our brains work, whether it's understanding the impact of trauma, whatever it is, we're always chasing this, and the core fundamental skills don't seem to improve. How do I know that? We track clinicians over time, and we can see that despite the fact that they feel better about their results, even believing and confidently asserting that they're improving over time, the data say they're not. In fact, if anything, the data say on balance, clinicians deteriorate in their effectiveness over time. And I would say one of the primary reasons for that is that they actually are confident about what they're doing. And these theories, if they add confidence to my beliefs and my way of working, then they're likely to be a negative impact on treatment outcomes.
And that's also interesting, Scott, because I, just as you were speaking, I was thinking there can be, or at least I've witnessed, a lot of presumption in the field of therapy from practitioners who make the assumption that if the therapist is the practitioner is a similar race, gender, sexual orientation of the client, that then massively boosts the empathy. But I think that can often be a presumption, can't it?
Well, I you know, if you can show me data to support that view, who was it who said you don't have to be a whale to write Moby Dick? The idea is that somehow like needs to treat like. If I'm an alcoholic, then I'm going to have better outcomes if I treat alcoholics. You know, what other field has this idea? Do I need to have had cancer in order to be an oncologist? It really doesn't make any sense. What there is data to support is, and this is what the new book is about, is that if therapists identify the weaknesses in their individual practice, in other words, they find out when they're not delivering these core ingredients of effective care, then they can deliberately practice and improve their outcomes. They can fill the gaps. But what that means is creating some kind of map about who you work well with and who you don't work well with. What moments in care seem to be your strong points and your weak points, and targeting the weaker ones, rather than constantly starting over with a new technique in the field based on categories that don't seem to have much to do with the outcome, like prior history of trauma. I know that is almost blasphemous to say so. My question would be, have you looked at whether or not your empathy, your ability to provide empathy to a person, is any worse when they happen to have had a traumatic event in their life? If it is, then maybe you need to train in that particular area. But if your data is just as positive when you're treating clients with a history of trauma and those without, why would you focus on that particular area?
that 1974 study, David Ricks, is it, on super
David
strings?
David F. Ricks. Yes.
Yeah. And then the 2003 multi-author study that
by Okishi,
that best therapists were 10 times better.
Yeah.
And the question then is why and how?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what I find amazing about this, Noel, is 1974 is when David Ricks publishes his article. Now, admittedly, it's in an obscure journal and very, very few people ever read. How do we know? We can look at how often the paper has been cited over time. But he publishes his paper. He finds something that every therapist knows secretly in their heart. And here's what all of us know who are practitioners. Some of us are better than others. We secretly know that. But we all act as though that's not the case. We're all equal in our ability to help people. And we assume that as long as you have the right technology applied to the right particular constellation of deficits or problems on the client's part, then we will get equal outcomes. Nothing could be further from the truth. And it's been far from the truth from the 1970s when we really started to gear up in terms of outcome research. Why didn't anybody ask after David F. Ricks published his study? Then in 2003, using a much more sophisticated way of monitoring outcomes, Mike Lambert and his team, led by, I believe, was a graduate student then, Okishi, they looked at thousands of cases and hundreds of therapists, and they found, again, that some were better than others. At the end of their article, they say it's a mystery how they do this. Nobody said anything. Nobody looked for anything. And I think this was our question as well, starting in the 2000s. We had been monitoring outcomes for some time. In fact, we'd given up on this idea of trying to find a method. I started with solution focused, but then I was deeply troubled by data, which indicated that we were no more effective than anyone else. And despite the claim that we were briefer, we weren't any briefer than anyone else. Therapy has always been relatively brief. If you look at how people use the service, it's always been relatively brief. So we were wondering then that given that we couldn't find that one method was better than another, that the whole focus on approach was really pretty baffling. So we said, let's just measure our outcomes. At least we'll know when we're helping and when we're not. And then when we're not helping, we can identify those cases and see if there's something more we can do. Soon we started to notice certain therapists rose to the top. And I will be completely frank in saying that initially I thought that was random variation, kind of like the stock market. In fact, I'd read this book, A Random Walk on Wall Street, and I thought, you know, some stocks are up for a while and then they're down. If you follow them over a long period of time, no stock is a winner all the time. They have ups and downs. That's what I thought. Well, that wasn't the case. These therapists were better. And as you pointed out in the Okishi study, 10 times better. This isn't some small insignificant thing. This is a huge difference, especially if you compound that impact over time, an entire therapist's career. What's even more challenging is the poor therapists in that study didn't really help anybody. In fact, many of them were worse off as a result of seeing the therapist. Wouldn't you want to know if that's you? Here's the scarier part. Ask those therapists, this is different research, it's not the Okishi study, but if you ask those therapists who are the least effective, they rate themselves as effective as the most effective. So there's no ability to distinguish on our part mediocrity from superior effectiveness. I wanted to know, well, how did they do it? And we watched videos, we pursued all of the traditional avenues to try to sort this. I was on a plane, true story, coming back, I believe, from Scandinavia, having done a workshop. I reached in the front pocket, and there was a magazine that I had never read before in my entire life, Fortune magazine. It's an investment magazine. I pulled it out, and I think the headline was something about the secret of top performers. Okay, so I opened it up, I started to read it, and here was this person named Anders Ericsson, a Swedish psychologist, now living in the United States. And for 40 years, he's been studying top performers across a variety of domains, chess, music, medicine, mathematics, surgery, computer programming, etc., trying to find out what led some to be best. Now, his initial conclusion was really kind of interesting, which was most of us spend our entire lives in a career. we often devote more time to our work life than we do to our family life. And yet most of us are no better at our jobs at the end of our careers than we were at the beginning, although most think they are. Well, of course, this rang a bell for me. This sounded like our field. And it was a huge puzzle. So when I say these facts, it's not specific to psychotherapy. It's not somehow psychotherapy is less than other real scientific professions. It's just part of human nature. Over time, our behavior becomes automatized. As a result, we lose control over that behavior. And we become confident because we're repeating the same patterns over and over and over again. And our explanatory system, accounting for our failures, grows also. So not only can we explain why we're successful, but we can certainly explain when we're not. And you know who usually gets the blame for that. And the client is resistant, they're not ready, they're not capable of a relationship, their diagnosis is too difficult, we need new treatment methods. It's all externalized in a way. When in fact, what Anders points was, is that we've been looking at expertise within this box we call therapy, and looking at what goes on back and forth between the two participants. If we could just figure out what the therapist says and does, what the client's pathology is, if we could understand this back and forth process, we could all copy it. Sort of similar to the assumption that if everybody swung a tennis racket like Federer, that we'd all be him. Well, that's a kind of a ludicrous idea if you think about it, which was, again, Anders' point. He said, if you want to understand why certain performers rise to the top within a particular human endeavor, you have to look at what they do before they play and after they play. And the top performers, he found, spend much more time engaged in an activity he later termed deliberate practice. Focused effort aimed at pushing your ability beyond what it is at present. And that's usually accomplished by targeting any areas of weakness. Now, I can't believe I didn't think about this. I mean, come on, it's not rocket science here. We're not sending people to the moon or Mars. What do you have to do to get better? Well, you have to identify where you're not actually good at something and then work at that. Okay, why hadn't I thought of that? Because I was so busy looking inside the box, believing that the technology would solve the problem. If I just knew how to say the right magical words, almost like a spell, then somehow the clients would get better. And if they didn't, well, that was because my words didn't fit their particular diagnosis or pattern, or I'm missing some new technique. Oh, baloney. I think in most instances, it's really about an inability to actualize core ingredients of effective change processes with that person and their context. And that means I have to identify what in me and my behavior is lacking so that I can work at that. Daryl Chow then went and did a study. It was the first study on deliberate practice in the history of our field. Our 2007 article called Super Shrinks, which appeared in the Psychotherapy Networker, was the first article ever to mention the term deliberate practice or apply its concepts to our particular field. Daryl does a retrospective study, and he finds, by looking at therapist outcomes, that the best spend 2.5 times more time during the week engaged in deliberate practice than their more average counterparts, and 14 times more time than the least effective in his sample. So is it the answer to effective psychotherapy? Well, no. But if you're already a psychotherapist and you want to get better, deliberate practice rather than another weekend workshop or even a year-long course in CBT or whatever the latest fascination is in our field is much more likely to improve your outcomes.
Wow. So that is essentially what your latest book is about.
It is. And what we do in the book is first teach therapists how to measure their results. Because if you don't know how effective and with whom and under what circumstances, you'll never be able to parse your performance into components small enough to target with deliberate practice efforts. I think of Olympic athletes. You know, in the Olympics, the outcomes of every single event have improved over the last century. Every single one. Us, no improvement at all. Our outcomes haven't improved at all. If you look at what athletes are doing, they don't have one coach anymore. They have five or six coaches, each one training to a very specific area, strength, agility, a whole host. They have an equipment coach. All of these coaches are looking for small areas that could be improved upon in the factors that matter for that particular performance. And we really haven't had that in therapy. I think in part because we've been distracted by this larger questions of theory and technique, divided what seemed to me to be along largely cultural lines, rather than core effective ingredient lines.
I can almost hear some of the people I trained with who were saying, well, the mind, the unconscious change cannot, the clinical outcomes, we can't apply this to the mind because it's not like how clinical effectiveness around dealing with what a surgeon does, where there's a right way and a wrong way of dealing with something, that the intricacies of power of relationship, other issues involved in terms of the nuances of that sort of therapeutic change. What would you say to that viewpoint?
Well, I mean, I have sort of two responses, an unhelpful one and a helpful one. Here's the unhelpful one. Have you tried?
Yeah.
Have you tried to measure? Have you read anything about measurement? If you haven't, then you're talking out of your ass.
Yes.
And you don't really know about this whole field of measurement, which has become really quite sophisticated. Are we all there? I hope not. You know, I'm hoping we'll get finer discriminations. Now, let me say something much more helpful, because I think that this speaks to an important idea in deliberate practice. So it's not me. It's our field that has been looking for invariant techniques. I've been talking strictly from the outset of our interview about core principles, DNA, and what constitutes empathy in the UK, I think will be different than what constitutes grossly here in the United States. And between me and another person who's similar to me and somebody who might be quite different. So that's where I think comments about the complex nature of our work come in. What I can do is measure your client's experience of empathy. And if the client isn't experiencing it, that's not because our minds are complex. That's because you didn't do something that for that client feels empathic. Now, what can I do to help train you? I can't teach you specific wording. That would be right back to the thing that's trapped us from the beginning, that if you just say the right magical words, it'll all work out. But I can teach you principles of empathic responding that are likely to increase the likelihood of the person opposite you experiencing your comments as empathic in nature. We have a brand new study that we're writing up now called the Difficult Conversations in Therapy Project, 3 randomized trials, where this is exactly what we do. We never tell the therapist exactly what to say. Instead, we measure their current level of empathic responding, and then we put them in set situations where they have to respond to a client in circumstances that might evoke a poor performance. And then we teach them core principles of empathic responding. And then that therapist, with their unique biology, culture, and background, can operationalize that principle in a way that works for them and hopefully their client. Am I making sense?
Yes, absolutely.
And I think this gets around this whole idea about complexity. We wouldn't have planes that fly if we thought aviation dynamics were complicated, too complicated for us to master, because, well, they are. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And I think this new and latest research about core principles and then helping individuals operationalize those in a way consistent with who they are, their biology, their background, their culture is one pathway through.
Yeah. Scott, I'm not sure if this is relevant, what I'm about to say, but in the past, when I, as a client seeking therapy from someone, certain people, not necessarily because they were necessarily doing anything wrong, I just didn't feel comfortable enough with them and the dynamic with them that I would feel able to disclose a lot of my real vulnerable personal material. What can be done about situations like that?
You mean that if you were in the client position, is that what you mean? If you were in the client, you wouldn't feel able to disclose to certain people.
Yes, and also what could a, if that be that as it may, and what can the therapist do to increase connection?
So this is going to seem perhaps a dodge, but if you weren't able or felt able to disclose to a therapist, my question is, were you helped anyway? That's my first question, because outcome trumps process. And the assumption in the question that you ask is that you have to feel comfortable and you have to disclose in order to get better. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe for that person, but not this person. This idea of confession is a uniquely Western idea. Is that a core principle? I don't know. So since outcome trumps process, I always have to have some measure of the outcome. Otherwise, I'm going to be chasing all of these millions of variations of ways that I can interact with an individual. Again, searching for the way to react with all of my clients. The point is to enact core principles that that client feels engaged by and which lead to a better outcome. So if you said to me that that influenced the outcome, you say dropped out or you didn't make progress, as a therapist, I want to make sure that two things. I can respond better in the moment to a client, but that's not learning. That's responsiveness. So how am I going to know if I need to respond differently to a client in the moment? I'm going to have to measure and see. I'm going to have to try to get feedback from the clients. Now, here's another interesting thing. Most therapists say they seek feedback, but when you watch their work, they don't. And so we've suggested that therapists use some sort of standardized outcome measure, an outcome and alliance measure. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But the data, I think, are pretty convincing that it augments therapists' ability to assess whether or not clients are in fact engaged with them and making progress at the same time. When I then get feedback that this client doesn't feel engaged, that they can't disclose, then that client and I can have a conversation about it. And I can see what I can do. I can talk with my supervisor. I can talk with colleagues and see, can I do anything in the moment? That's responsiveness. You can't learn from that, because clients are the wild card in therapy. Something like 93% of the variance in treatment outcomes is controlled by who walks into the door. So I think therapists at one level do an amazing job responding to that variance, except when we don't, in that instance you're just mentioning. I then have to have a help responding to that client. In order to learn, however, I don't need one case. I need multiple cases where I can look for patterns. Well, it's interesting. It turns out that with women, I am not as experienced by them as empathic when they're expressing feelings of anger towards me. So if I then see a pattern, that's more an activity that I could apply deliberate practice to for improving my particular outcome. So there's the one-offs where I have to be responsive in the moment. And then there's looking, standing back from my data with my clients and working at identifying patterns in that data of deficits.
Yeah. And that's definitely the benefits of being reflective and being open to feedback, because we probably all know people that become very defensive, who are not actually open to true feedback, because it might mean a slight on how they work, and that would be an awful thing.
Well, it's an interesting piece. Again, I think our behavior over time, this is Anders' work, I can't take any credit for it. Our behavior over time becomes routinized and automatic. It becomes unconscious, so to speak. We're not aware of it anymore. That's not a bad thing in general. You couldn't walk, for example, if you had to control mentally every muscle in your leg and your balance and forward, you couldn't walk. So at one time you were mindful of that. When you were just getting up on your feet, you were mindful of every step you took. The problem is, the longer you're walking, the more you think you're doing it better and better. And that means you're not going to improve at walking unless somebody puts you in a situation that challenges you. Then you're going to have to notice that, and you're probably going to need an expert or a coach to coach you through that small deficit. This isn't something I think most of us can solve in our minds through reflection. Neither do I think that we can notice these detailed aspects of our performance. We're not good at assessing our deficits over hundreds and hundreds of cases. We're very good at responsiveness in the moment, but we're just not able to see where we fall short. At least Amazon has it. I know you can order it directly from the APA website. And again, what we do in that book is we initially show you how to create a map of your performance using your outcome data generated by your clients working with you. Then to identify the small areas where improvement could take place, we include a tool called the TDPA, the Taxonomy of Deliberate Practice Activities, that helps you map your performance onto factors that we know matter. And I've only mentioned one of them, that's empathy. There are many, and you may find that your deficits lie elsewhere. And then how to develop exercises that specifically work those weaker therapeutic muscles with an effort aimed at and a goal of improving your outcomes in the long run. Superior athletes don't have a supervisor. They have coaches specific to different areas of their performance. And that means that the job and the challenge for therapists is to find the right coach. Once you've identified an area of deficit, and the recommendation we give is reach for the top. Reach for the person whose subject area is your particular deficit. And there are lots of people writing about empathy or goal consensus or structure and focus in a session or the creation of hope and expectation. These are areas that the research literature says have an impact on outcome. So, but that right now and at present really falls on the therapist's shoulders to find that particular person. And I also say it's a little bit like finding a therapist, that is finding a coach. Just because the first one doesn't serve you right, don't give up. It takes a while.
Yes, and don't enter into co-narcissistic relationships where you find someone that you think has got the answers to everything and they're set up as well to feel like they have to have the answers to everything. And then you're kind of like going down a blind alley sometimes. Fantastic. I've learned so much, Scott. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you for the chat.
My pleasure.
For more information on this topic, visit scottdmiller.com. And noelbell.net.